But the 4th century saw the birth of St. Augustine of Hippo, the finest philosophical mind since Aristotle. St. Augustine was troubled by the lack of intellectual content in Christianity and found himself attracted to Neoplatonism. St. Augustine eventually succeeded in reconciling the philosophy of Plotinus with Orthodox Christian theology. In this way, Christianity was given a firmer intellectual foundation, and the evolved ideas of Plato were grafted onto the only intellectual force that proved able to survive the Dark Ages. Platonism, of one sort or another, thus became part of the Christian tradition, which through the centuries produced a succession of thinkers who understood Plato better than Plato, the Platonists, the Neoplatonists, St. Augustine, and so forth. Platonists continued to flourish in major European universities, especially in Germany and at Cambridge, until well into the 20th century. But the species is now thought to be extinct. From Plato's writings. Philosophy begins in wonder. Theaetetus, 155d. Here is a parable which shows how our nature may become enlightened or remain unenlightened. Imagine the condition of men as living in a sort of underground cavern with a long entrance open to the light. Here men have existed since childhood, fettered by the leg and the neck, so that they cannot move or turn their heads in any way and can only see in front of them. Higher up, and some distance behind them, is the light of a burning fire, and between the fire and the prisoners is a path with a parapet along it, like the screen at a puppet show which conceals the performers while they display their puppets above it. "I can picture it," he replied. "Now behind the parapet imagine there are men carrying all kinds of objects, including figures of men and animals, in stone and wood and various other materials, which project above the parapet. Some of these people would be speaking, and some would be silent." "This is a strange image you conjure up," he said, "and those chained men are strange prisoners." "No, they are just like us," I replied, "for to begin with, do you think such prisoners would see anything of themselves or of one another, except for the shadows cast by the firelight onto the wall of the cave facing them? How could they see more if their heads are prevented from turning? And they would see just as little of the objects being carried past, of course. Now, if they were able to talk to one another, surely they would suppose that in naming the shadows they saw, they were in fact naming the actual objects." "Certainly. And if their prison had an echo from the wall facing them, when one of the passers-by behind them spoke, the prisoners would naturally assume this came from the shadow passing before their eyes." "By Zeus, they would indeed," he said. "In all ways, then, the prisoners would consider reality to be nothing else than the shadows of those artificial objects." "Inevitably," he agreed. The Republic, Book 7, 514a-c. We must then conclude that education is not, as some claim, the introducing into a soul of knowledge which was not there beforehand, as if they were introducing sight into a blind eye. That is what they say it is. But our argument shows that the capacity for understanding truth is innate in each man's soul, and that the way in which he learns is like an eye which cannot be turned from the darkness toward the light except by turning the whole body. In the same way, the entire soul must be turned away from this world of change and shadows until its eye is able to endure the bright, shining light of reality, and the brightest of all realities which we have called the good. The Republic, Book 7, 518b-c. God is blameless. The Republic, Book 10, 617e. Do not forget that popular favour is a way to achievement, whereas an arbitrary temper has solitude for company. Letters 4, 321c. A man is just in the same way that a state is just. And we must not forget that justice in the state means that each of the three classes found within it is performing its proper function. Each of us is just and does his duty only when each part of us performs its proper function. The Republic, Book 4, 441d. See in some translations. It is the business of reason to rule, exercising wisdom and foresight on behalf of the entire soul, while the spirited element should act as its subordinate and ally. When these two elements have been reared and trained to understand their own true functions, they should be set to rule over the mass of our appetites, which make up by far the largest part of our soul, and are by nature insatiable. These ever-demanding appetites must be watched over with constant vigilance, so as to prevent them from gorging themselves on the so-called pleasures of the body, and thus becoming so huge and insatiable that the body no longer fulfills its proper role, but instead attempts to overturn and enslave the entire life of man. The Republic, Book 4, 441e, 442a. I had a dream. And in this dream I was told that the first elements, out of which all things, including you and I, are made, are such that no one can give an explanation of them. Each of them by itself can only be named. We cannot attribute anything further to them. We cannot even say that they exist, or that they do not exist, if we mean to speak of them alone, for to do so would be to imply the attributes of existence or non-existence. We cannot define any of these primeval elements. They can only be named, for they have nothing but a name. Yet the things composed of these elements, because they are thus complex, are defined by a combination of names which makes up a description, for a description is the essence of their definition. Theaetetus, 201e, b in some translations, 202b. Suppose that when someone sees or hears or notices something, he says to himself, "What I perceive looks rather like something else, though it is in fact only a poor imitation." Don't you agree that the person who receives this impression must have had previous knowledge of that something else, and is in fact being reminded of it? Of course. Then we must have had some earlier knowledge of equality, before we first saw things which were almost equal without being fully so. I agree. And at the same time, we agree that we did not and could not have come by this notion of equality, except by sight, or touch, or one of the senses. I am treating them as all being the same. They are, Socrates, for the purposes of our argument. So it must be by the senses that we become aware of the notion that things which are almost equal are not absolutely equal. Yet we must have a notion of this absolute equality, or there would be no standard with which to compare the things that we perceive as being almost equal. That sounds logical enough, Socrates. But surely we first see and hear and use our senses only at birth. Of course. But previously we agreed that we must have knowledge of equivalence and non-equivalence before we use our senses, or we would not be able to make any sense of them. Yes. Which means we must have had this knowledge before we were born. So it appears. Therefore, if we had this knowledge before we were born, and knew it when we were born, this means we had knowledge not only of equality and relative equivalence, but also of all absolute standards, and this same argument which we applied to absolute equality applies just as much to the absolutes of beauty, goodness, morality, and holiness. And also, I maintain, to all those characteristics to which we apply the term absolute. This shows that we must obtain knowledge of such absolutes before we were born. Phaedo, 73c, 74e, end, et seq. It is said that Socrates had a dream about a cygnet which sat on his knees. It quickly grew plumage and became a swan, then flew off, letting out a loud, sweet cry. Next day, Plato was introduced to Socrates as a pupil, and Socrates immediately recognized him as the swan in his dream. Diogenes Laertius, Lives of the Eminent Philosophers, Book 3, 5. The Other Side of Plato. The strongest principle is that everybody, whether they are male or female, should have a leader. Likewise, no one should get into the habit of doing anything at all on his own initiative, either in earnest or in jest. Both in war and during time of peace, he should respect his leader and follow him faithfully. He should look up to his leader and follow his guidance in even the smallest matters. For example, he should get up, move around, wash, and have his meals, only at such times as he has been ordered to do so. In other words, he should get into the habit, by a long process of training, of never even dreaming or acting independently, and thus becoming utterly incapable of such action. In this way, the life of all is spent in total community. There is no law, and there never will be one, which is above this. It is the most effective way of achieving salvation and victory in war, and in peacetime, and from earliest childhood, this should remain the highest law, the need to rule others and be ruled by others.